The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermack. Coming up on today's program, Haiti faces a massive political and security crisis. We'll look at why Kenya is still considering coming to the nation's aid. After that, we'll look at why cocoa prices around the world are surging and what that means for Ghanaian farmers. We'll also hear from Monocle's own team in Hong Kong, wrapping up today's Chiefs Conference. We'll get a business roundup from Dubai. And finally, it is Thursday, which can only mean one thing. Welcome back, Fernando. We're switching it up a little bit this week.
Absolutely, Chris. So for today's Global Countdown, we look at the world's top five music markets.
Number one won't surprise you. Number two might. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermack. In Haiti, a political crisis continues to spiral out of control as security forces working for a government that has yet to be named are attempting to fend off gangs trying to take over the capital, Port-au-Prince. One country that has pledged to help stem the violence is Kenya, which continues to debate whether to send hundreds of police officers to the Caribbean nation to help restore a measure of peace. But it is a deployment that has not gone down particularly well in Kenya itself. To tell us more, we're joined now by Caroline Kimeu, East Africa correspondent for The Guardian. Caroline, let's step back first of all. What prompted Kenya to get involved here in Haiti in the first place?
Right, Chris. It's very layered, and I can tell you, for the most part, the public has also remained, you know, baffled as to Kenya's intentions, its interests in the Haiti mission. However, according to, you know, the leaders and some analysts I spoke with who, you know, understand the situation quite well, what happened is there were talks when Kenya was on the Security Council about more cooperation between African and Caribbean nations, and especially regarding the security situation in Haiti. So from the leader's standpoint, that's when it began. And, you know, as you know, like, there is a huge historical and cultural ties between African countries and Caribbean countries as far as the struggle for independence. So there is a lot of solidarity in that sense and a lot of empathy for the situation they faced post, you know, enslavement and after they won their freedom in 1804, having to go on to make century-long payments to former French colonizers and then entering into a very deep debt cycle that has had lasting impacts on Haiti. And then not to mention going forward to the, you know, decades of U.S. occupation, which was quite brutal and, like, oversaw many human rights abuses and economic exploitation. So that's the standpoint from the leaders. But there are multiple reasons going in, multiple interests. You know, Kenya, it has also been seen that Kenya is trying to maintain relations with its ally, the U.S., you know, and that's, you know, that's a bit of a double-edged sword too, as far as how the mission is perceived, because there is some sense both in Haiti and Kenya that Kenya is serving, you know, quote unquote, imperialistic interests, given the history of U.S. intervention there, given, you know, the poor history of UN interventions, you know, which had instances of sexual abuse in the peacekeeping missions, as well as in the you know, introduction of cholera. So, you know, right now, as it stands, the leaders in Kenya haven't done a very wonderful job at explaining to the public what is Kenya's interest in going there, while the country faces many security situations of its own. So there has been criticism as to, you know, what are the needs? Like, you know, we have fires of our own to put out here, but also where the procedures followed, you know, what was being greenlighted in the UN, it hadn't yet had the public buy-in here.
Well, one aspect, Caroline, that you didn't perhaps mention there is just generally Kenya having a history of being involved in peacekeeping missions. That comes sort of in addition to some of the solidarity with a nation like Haiti that you were speaking of there. I just wonder how Kenyans feel about these kinds of peacekeeping missions in general. Have they always been controversial in Kenya, or is there something different about Haiti?
I think so. Missions like Somalia, for instance, you know, there have been questions, especially when it was perceived that, you know, military forces there were in particular danger. It has always led to some questions by the public. That's what happened, you know, in such situations. But I think with Haiti, it's more heightened because, as I mentioned, the lead up to Kenya accepting to take on the mission hasn't been very, there hasn't been much public participation, neither has there been a good PR campaign, so to speak, from the government, because immediately it was announced, it was followed by legal obstacles. And, you know, from then on, it's just been one thing after the other, with the resignation now of Prime Minister, the Haitian Prime Minister, Ariel Henry. It's become even more controversial because people are quite, you know, now starting to question if, you know, the Prime Minister himself is, you know, is seen in that light, as awareness in Kenya of the situation in Haiti grows, seeing that, you know, he got locked out of his own country and ousted in that way has definitely set off alarm bells among the public as to the safety of the force that's being deployed.
Well, and Kenya has, to your point about Ariel Henry resigning, Kenya has paused this mission for now, citing the lack of a government in Haiti and the security situation kind of spiraling out of control. What are the chances then, also given the public skepticism that you talk about, what are the chances that it would be picked up again if, say, a transitional government in Haiti is put in place?
I mean, I would actually think it's still very highly likely to move forward, given how far this has gone internationally. Kenya stepping up in this way, it would be a very odd dynamic for Kenya to backtrack, which isn't to say that there is not likely to be legal challenges. I think as soon as a transitional government comes into place, everything is likely to repeat itself. We're likely to see position go back to court, raise some of the issues, including the validity of the agreement that was signed between Ariel Henry and Kenyan President William Ruto, you know, which people have questioned. Is it valid? Because, you know, some of the processes that are required legally from this end, you know, gazettement of the, you know, the fact that such a deal has happened, and then also public participation were not done. People have also questioned the capacity of the outgoing, the Haitian Prime Minister, to even enter into such an agreement, considering that he was unelected. But at the same time, Kenyan authorities have been super, you know, bullish about, you know, moving forward with this mission and have indicated, you know, an intention to press on when, you know, a transitional government is in place.
And just finally then, Caroline, if they are going to press on, as you suggest, I just wonder what kind of impact this could have on Kenya's government and William Ruto, especially if things go badly. Like, how much is this a topic within Kenya compared to many of the other sort of domestic or other issues that Kenya might be having? How much of an impact politically could this have?
I think as more awareness goes, you know, comes into play because of the kind of, you know, situation with the legal case that has drummed up both interest and awareness of the issues happening in Haiti, and ask people, you know, watch their TV, see what's happening there, wonder why Kenya is putting itself. You know, it does seem that because this mission is being pushed more heavily from the leadership side without that public buy-in, it's a tricky situation. But again, like, there are many policies or many Kind of initiatives that have been pushed forward without full public buy-in, so to speak, and then you know, the Kenyan courts being super active in this way. So I do think that Kenya is used to a bit of a push and pull. I don't think it will be a fatal blow to William Ruto, but however, seeing that he's trying to build the country's international profile through this mission, I think you know, it would be in everybody's interest that this goes well. So I do think for the government, there's a lot riding on it.
Thanks very much, Caroline. That was Caroline Kimeu, East Africa correspondent for The Guardian. Now here's Vincent McAvinney with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The UN's most senior human rights official, Volker Türk, has said there is a plausible case that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Mr. Türk, who is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said that if intent was proven, it would amount to a war crime. Israel's economy minister Nir Barkat has dismissed the warning as total nonsense and a totally irresponsible thing to say. Efforts have been started to dismantle the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, the first step on the long road towards reopening the port of Baltimore and alleviating the disruptions to global shipping and the local economy. Officials announced late Wednesday they were pausing the search for the bodies of four road workers who were plunged into the Patapsco River during the bridge's collapse. And Harvard University has removed the binding of human skin from a 19th century book kept in its library. Des Destinées de l'âme, translated as Destinies of the Soul by Arsène Houssaye, has been housed at the Houghton Library since the 1930s. Scientists determined a decade ago the tome's unusual binding was skin. Harvard said the remains of the unclaimed woman thought to have died of natural causes will be given a respectful disposition that seeks to restore her dignity. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Vincent. This weekend is Easter in many parts of the world, and with that, of course, comes a tremendous surge in the demand for chocolate. It's typically a boon for cocoa-producing nations, but this year the industry has been rocked by surging prices and crop failures from heavy rains and disease, particularly in Ghana and the Ivory Coast. Cocoa prices hit $10,000 per metric ton for the first time ever this week, but the question is whether farmers are seeing any of those profits. Well, joining us now is Joseph Appiah Dauphine, journalist in Accra, Ghana, contributor at the Africa Report. Joseph, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us about the situation for Ghana's cocoa farmers at the moment.
Well, currently, cocoa farmers in Ghana are not so happy, even though the world prices is skyrocketing, simply because we deal with a system where we have a forward trade or forward sale. So actually what is happening now is of no effect to the farmers here in Ghana.
That makes sense, isn't it? It's part of the problem that even if, you know, cocoa prices are surging, have tripled in the last year, farmers reach deals well ahead of time. So is there any way in which this is getting back to Ghana at all? Or are there efforts to try and sort of recuperate some of those profits to help the situation in Ghana going forward?
I think that it's always a difficult situation because, one, nobody predicted that the price would get to this stage. Authorities in Ghana have said that this issue, in fact, the declining production numbers in Ghana is mainly because of climate change, diseases and smuggling. And so the government in its own way has been trying to sort out these issues. One, they are trying to deal with the issues of smuggling. Recently, three people were arrested at the Togo border, smuggling cocoa beans to Togo. And so the government is on course to dealing with such issues. One, there is also illegal mining, which the government has pledged to also work on. And so going forward, it's like a difficult situation for the farmers here, but authorities have been urging calm since it's a global problem.
It is a difficult situation for farmers there. And from some of the things you mentioned there, I just wonder to what extent This has been a surprise, I suppose. Prices have risen so strongly as if this were a one-time problem. And yet the way you describe some of these issues, whether it's smuggling, but also disease, the effect of climate change, this is sort of a new reality for a place like Ghana, isn't it? Rather than a one-time problem with crops.
Yeah, it is. It is a reality in Ghana. And, you know, it's the declining of cocoa production is something that was not anticipated, but nature has its own way of doing things. One, the farm gate prices, government increased farm gate prices for farmers in a way to increase production. The government currently is undertaking rehabilitation of old cocoa farms, old cocoa trees, so that at least the farmers could up their production levels. But still, this is persistent, and the farmers are a bit worried. But the cocoa board has been assuring them of pragmatic solutions to the current challenges.
Is there something that Ghana is looking for from the international community on that, particularly when it comes to something like the effect of climate change? Is there any sort of aid that Ghana can expect from the international community to help mitigate some of these consequences?
Yeah, I think that it's a multifaceted problem. And for instance, the cocoa board, the regulator of the cocoa sector in Ghana, has been trying to received this 200 million syndicated loan, which has been difficult going out there to the international market amid the current economic challenges. And so it's a difficult situation for the regulator here, because once this 200 million syndicated loan is able to come in to the system, then it could mean that there is an increased support to farmers, and then production could be up, and then the declining fortunes will begin to sort of turn around. But this 200 million syndicated loan hasn't come in yet, and that is what the government is looking up to the international community to come in to help.
And just finally, Joseph, I wonder if you could describe a little bit the impact that this has on Ghana. I mean, West Africa, including Ghana, produces some 70% of the world's cocoa. But how much does Ghana itself depend on the cocoa trade for its economy?
It's cocoa and agriculture has been the backbone of Ghana's economy. And so if there are declining fortunes, obviously it will have adverse effect on Ghana. And this is what we are seeing. Currently, almost half of the production in the country is off. I mean, we anticipated to produce about 590,000 for this crop season, but we are barely making 400,000 now. We used to hit like 1 million. In 2020, 2021, we made about 1 million metric tons. Now we are making barely 400,000. So you could see the impact in terms of the cash flow into the country's economy. And that is what is affecting us now. And then secondly, because world prices had gone up, processing companies here cannot really afford these high prices in beans, and so they are also, their production levels have also dropped significantly here. Yeah,
an incredible drop in terms of cocoa production there. Joseph Apia Dolphine, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing, and I'm Chris Chermak. We head to Hong Kong now, where Monocle is wrapping up its very own Chiefs Conference, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief and Asia Editor, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, great to have you on. I understand it is cocktail hour over there. What's been going on?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Glass of champagne in my hand as we speak. Yeah, so we just wrapped up the conference. We've had a full day of I mean, brilliant conversation. It was just such a success. It was so interesting. I mean, it started last night already, you know, the conversation began. We had drinks at the Armory, which is this fantastic shop that is owned by Mark Cho, who's one of the speakers today, in the Pedro Arcade. It's an old building that he's really spruced up beautifully, and he's installed this wonderful bar. So we really started the conference last night. We had a full day of panels, speakers, lunch, and the chat continues. We've got drinks, then dinner, and then who knows where the evening leads. As you know, it's a Monocle event. It could go anywhere.
It could go wherever you'd like it to go, absolutely. But before we get to the full evening festivities, tell us more about what happened today. What kind of panels, which guests struck you in particular?
Well, I mean, the thing that really struck me was the, you know, the diversity of the guests. I think, you know, we talked about this, that often people outside the region just think of Asia as this sort of block, this region. And what was really interesting about today was we had people from Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, Japan, Hong Kong, of course. You know, and it's just how different every market is, where people are in terms of retail, design. Everyone's got their own specific market, and I think it's really interesting to see all those differences, some connection points. And it's great in the bits, the sort of sidelines of the conference, which, you know, you would find any conference, people were really connecting, and you know, even a few business deals being done. So yeah, there were a lot of highlight speakers. I mean, you know, you don't want to pick people out because it's as if you're not enjoying the others, but I did enjoy Mark Cho's chat about, you know, he's a man committed to a tie and a proper suit. And it was interesting hearing him talk about that. How did the business survive the pandemic? I had a great conversation with Yuta Oka, who's built this wonderful hotel in the inland sea in Japan. It's not an obvious location. It's miles from anywhere, really, offshore Hiroshima. And just talking about how the commitment you need to build that kind of hotel on an island, you know, it's a depopulated area, and how do you bring back the area along with the hotel? We had architect Kevin Motlow. He was great, very interesting, quite, you know, he's punchy. He was talking about really architects being quite selfish generally. He said he's very harsh on architects, but he was talking about how architects need to think more about their neighbours. If you're building a huge tower in a residential neighbourhood, is it fair? And so he's very much working in that Asian context, emerging cities, building tower blocks in low-rise neighborhoods. So many, many good moments.
Did you learn something specific, I suppose, about how Asia has been coming back from the pandemic, as you mentioned there, both hospitality but also cities? It's something that has been difficult for a number of countries there, and also, of course, for Hong Kong itself.
Yeah, I think that was really interesting. I think, you know, it's so easy to complain about things, but when you hear from the people who are running the businesses about the challenges they've faced, I particularly thought, I enjoyed the conversation with Noni Purnomo, who runs Bluebird Taxis in Indonesia, big taxi business, and just the challenges they faced between the pandemic and the rise in, you know, Uber and all the sort of hail businesses that they didn't anticipate, of course, when they started their businesses in 1972. And I found that very, very interesting. She was really inspiring. She was very kind of, you know, always saying perseverance is a big thing. And I think all the businesses really talked about how they'd been impacted by the pandemic and how they'd got through it. Some people saw it as a positive, a chance to sort of think about what do they really want to do. But, you know, we had the mall group from Thailand, obviously huge business in Thailand, talking about what is the mall business like there. And then we had developers from Vietnam saying it's a different ecosystem there. You know, people like to be out on the street. So I think you came away with your head just bursting with ideas. And the great thing was there was plenty of opportunity just to have casual chats. It's a very informal setting. And I think people really, really enjoyed it. They are enjoying it, I should say. Keep it in the present tense.
Keep it absolutely in the present tense. And Fiona, just finally, you being there, going from Tokyo to Hong Kong, I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about your relationship with Hong Kong and also Japan's relationship in that sense with Hong Kong. How were people talking about that? How has that evolved?
Well, I've been coming to Hong Kong for a really long time, since I was at school, in fact. So I really know it kind of, you know, it's been a long relationship and I love it here. I haven't been for a long time. And I think a lot of people were saying the same thing. They said during the pandemic, it was very closed off here and people didn't come, obviously, from outside. And then they slightly got out of the habit of coming here. And this was a really good chance to come back, see what's been going on. Obviously, a lot's been going on. So that was really interesting. I think coming from Japan, we're seeing a lot of people from Hong Kong in Japan at the moment. Tourism to Tokyo is just off the charts at the moment. And we're seeing a lot of people from all over the region, but lots of people from Hong Kong. There's amazing kind of interaction in terms of retail, hospitality. You're seeing restaurants. There's just such an exchange. And I think people are traveling again a lot now. So I found that really interesting. And you know, people talking about what's the mood in the city now. And I think a very interesting speaker was Angel Siangle, who's the director of Art Basel, which is on, it's on right now. The previews have just been happening. And clearly big business is being done. And she was talking about the fact that it's her second year as director. It really feels like business is back. You know, they've got a lot of Chinese buyers. There was concern about the Chinese economy, but judging from the sort of pre-opening sales, it's looking quite positive. So I think there's so much energy in this region, and everyone's got something interesting to learn from everyone else. And I noticed that, you know, the people from Bangkok were very interested to hear what's going on in Ho Chi Minh. You know, they want that information, that insider information. So it was interesting for me personally, but I think for other people participating, I think they learned a lot, and I'm absolutely sure things will come out of it.
Fiona Wilson, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing. I'm Chris Chermak. Time now for a business roundup with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us from Dubai, probably for the last time, at least from Dubai, that is. Ewan, let's start with something outside of Dubai, though. Tech stocks have had a tremendous start to the year, but the one company that you always was once the darling, Tesla, has been missing out on the rally.
Chris, yeah, we're just about at the end of the first quarter of 2024. The time has gone so quickly. At the end of last year, remember that stocks had a real bumper quarter. The final 3 months of last year saw stocks rallying around the world on hopes of central bank easing cuts to interest rates over the coming year. A lot of analysts were wondering how far it could go. Well, it's gone much further. Stocks up a lot over the course of this 3 months. But one of those companies missing out has been Tesla, down 28% over the course of the last 3 months. That compares to a 10% advance in the wider US S&P. Now, the EV maker is due to provide a first quarter delivery update next week. And there have been lots of rapidly dropping estimates over the past month, not just for deliveries, but for revenue and profit. Analysts have really turned rather sour on the stock. The biggest cloud looming over Tesla is the slowdown in demand for electric vehicles. This is something we've been discussing more broadly on Bloomberg for a few months now. There's lots of discussion about how quickly people are going to adopt electric vehicles. The global market for EVs is currently about 7%. 7% of deliveries are fully plug-in electric. That still means that 93% of cars sold at the moment are non-plug-in electric. And there's a lot of speculation that people who have EVs, people who want EVs, have already got one. And it's moving to becoming a mass market technology, which is taking rather longer than lots of other people thought. And what's worse for Tesla is that this is happening just as competition from the legacy car makers is ramping up. They are all spending huge amounts of money converting their ranges to electric. And the Chinese rivals, well, they are really hotting up as well. BYD of China recently overtook Tesla as the biggest EV maker in the world. And whilst self-driving cars, which Tesla has been putting a lot of money into developing, would be a major feat, that remains a problem which is notoriously difficult to solve. And analysts don't expect that to become widely adopted technology anytime soon. So a lot of headwinds for Tesla at the moment.
Now, Ewan, you will be heading back from Dubai to London shortly. You were among one of the many expats in the city for the last few months. Tell us about some of the other groups of expats you know there. There are some signs that, at least for one group, the allure of the city is waning.
Yeah, one thing you notice when you walk around the Dubai is that there are a lot of Russians here. Now, maybe it's not that surprising because unlike the US and the EU, the United Arab Emirates doesn't have any sanctions on Russia. But there's a good story on the Bloomberg today that the allure is starting to dim as the cost of living in Dubai surges. And Russian entities setting up bank accounts are now more likely to face scrutiny from local banks as the country comes under increased pressure from the US and others to tackle potential evasion of sanctions. Now, bankers based in Dubai that we've spoken to say that although average middle-class Russians who aren't sanctioned have largely not faced big issues opening accounts. Several sanctioned Russians have been rejected by banks. This is something which wasn't the case a couple of years ago. And there are signs that Russian money flows into the United Arab Emirates are starting to slow down as well. According to professionals we've spoken to, some Russians are starting to return home now as the expat rush into Dubai drives up rent and daily expenses. This is not a cheap place to live. And in fact, the surge of Russians coming here is one of the things which has driven up rents so much. Rents are currently rising at a really pretty fair pace, which you wouldn't expect to see elsewhere in the world. And in rankings of real estate buyers, back in 2022, Russians were number one. But over the last year, they've slipped back to number three, trailing Indians and the Brits. So there are signs that the tide of Russians is starting to slow a little bit.
And Ewan, just final thoughts from you as you are returning from Dubai to London. Any particular impressions you will be taking with you back over here?
Well, other than the lovely weather, which I'm sure you don't want to know about being based in London, I mean, it's really a fantastic powerhouse of an economy. It's something which has been built over quite a short period of time. When I was born, Dubai barely existed. The United Arab Emirates was really not really a country with anything much in it other than a lot of desert. But they built really a fantastic economic powerhouse. It's been built on a lot of expat labor. There are many people here from all over the West. It attracts people, not just because of the lifestyle, but also because of decent wages and virtually no tax. But it is also built on the labor of migrant workers from South Asia. There are lots and lots of people here from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. In fact, South Asians make up about half of Dubai's population. They come here on very different terms to people from the West. They work for much lower wages and much longer hours, but it does still continue to attract them, and many of them stay for many years. So they've really built a fantastic economic model. Of course, some of the human rights and labor rights are not what we would expect in Europe. But in terms of the economy and the thriving metropolis, which I can see out of the window now, it's a pretty impressive place.
Ewan Potts, thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to hearing from you from London in future again. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, our senior correspondent and musical curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is back in the studio for our weekly Global Countdown, as you heard from the little jingle there. Faye, it's another special one this week. We're not looking at one country, but at the top track across five countries. Tell us why, first of all.
Well, I do this once a year because last week they released the report, the global music report for 2023. And there are a lot of interesting numbers in there, including the top five music markets. So I decided, let's look at the number one song in those countries. And I think it's quite interesting to see if there's any difference, if perhaps might be quite similar.
It is quite an eclectic mix, I have to say.
I love that. But by the way, the top five didn't change compared to 2022. So no surprises there. But shall we start with number five? We are in China. All I can say about the song, this guy has got an ethereal voice. It's a beautiful track. Very traditional as well, Chris. Let's have a listen to number five, Zhu Shan with Xiao Meng Man.
Is this going to make the Monocle Radio playlist,
Faye? I'm not quite sure, but I admire the voice. I mean, it is
a strong voice.
It's so clear. And it's funny because Zhu Shan, I was reading, he first studied dentistry in Ukraine. But then after 1 year, he said, you know what, maybe dentistry is not my thing. And then he went to music school in Lviv as well. So there's a disconnection there. But then he came back to China. And this song is the soundtrack of a very popular comedy in China at the moment. It's in the cinemas. It's called YOLO. So if you're interested and you want to watch it. But the song is quite beautiful. And it means little happiness.
Oh, well, that's sweet.
Not too much happiness.
Just a little happiness.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. We all need a little happiness in our lives, at least. Well, let's move on to number four, Germany, a country I know relatively well. What's been happening over there?
Although Germany does have a strong set of artists, especially the hip-hop scene in Germany is quite big.
I've been telling people in the office this.
And I agree with you, Chris. I will definitely agree with you. But they don't have a German artist at the number one song. It's Benson Boone. He's a very young American. He's only 21. And I think his growth was a little bit organic. He was on social media. And then after he auditioned to American Idol. But look at him. He's everywhere. That's the number one video worldwide, not only in Germany. But let's have a listen to this ballad by Benson Boone, Beautiful Things. These beautiful things that I've got, please stay. I want you, I need you, oh God, don't take.
That sort of social media rise, as you were saying, is kind of emblematic of how music has changed, hasn't it? Which is the point of that report from last week.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because perhaps the path of artists is not that traditional anymore. It's not that someone in a label finds you. I mean, of course, they will find you after. You might get a contract after you became popular on social media. But Benson Boone is this typical classic example. And by the way, we have one of his tracks on the Monaco radio playlist. Not Beautiful Things, because this one, although I think it's fine, it's a little bit kind of too common, I think. I don't know. It's
a little too rocky for Monaco radio.
A little
radio.
Too rocky, perhaps. But, you know, well done. And his global tour starts in April in Chicago.
There we go. Well, let's move on to the UK, where we've done a little bit of a fudge. We're going to be honest about this, because we could have also played Benson Boone for the UK. What have you done, Faye?
I knew that there was a risk. yes, the number one in the UK is also Benson Boone with Beautiful Things. But, you know, we don't want to hear it again, right? I mean, fair enough for those.
We'll leave our listeners to do that.
Exactly. So I looked at the albums chart and I looked who was the number one artist in the albums chart. And that's Ariana Grande's latest release, Eternal Sunshine. And I chose the latest single. We're going to hear it right now. It's a great song. This is Ariana Grande with We Can't Be Friends, Wait For Your Love.
This one gets the vote from our producer, Vincent McAvini, today.
And I have to agree, it's very Robin-esque, melancholic electropop. That's my cup of tea. And, you know, we don't have that song on the playlist yet, but I will be adding that, Chris.
You will be adding. It is official. We can announce this here on the Global Countdown.
A lot of Americans so far. Germany, in the UK. So see, the US is still...
Well,
was
it a couple of weeks ago you added a few Finnish tracks, I remember, to Monaco Radio from the Global Countdown? So, you know, you move around.
Exactly. Number two is perhaps the most interesting one of them all. It's Japan.
It is, which is interesting that it's always been there, as you say, or last year as well. But I wouldn't have necessarily expected Japan to be number two.
And before I introduce you to Japan, they consume music very different than other countries. Let's say the UK, for example. Physical media is huge in Japan, but it's not even this kind of vinyl renaissance. They still buy CDs. It's still a large part of their music consumption. And they're listening to less and less Western artists. There was a time where it was 30% of the market. I mean, the Japanese, even Western artists, they released special editions to Japan. But now, looking at the Japanese top 100 tracks from last year, only 0.3% of songs, I mean, during all the weeks, were from Western artists. That's a very small number.
Is that because the Japanese industry is getting better or there's less traction from Western artists?
They are getting better, but to be honest, the Japanese are still interested in music from other countries, just not perhaps from Europe or the US. They're looking, I mean, K-pop is doing so well in Japan and, you know, other countries as well in Asia, even maybe some Afrobeats here and there. But number two, we're going to talk about it, but I love the name. Creepy Nuts with Bling Bang Bang Born.
ライバル口を揃えてマグでマグで認めるぜってマジでこれをもう全部生身で I mean, this is just mad, which does kind of make it my favorite because it's just so bizarre. But it's sort of the kind of track that could be on Eurovision, frankly, as well.
And it's becoming global. This track is global. I think you could even win Eurovision. So they are a hip-hop duo, R. Shitei and DJ Matsunaga. And for those who don't know, DJ Matsunaga performed at the closing ceremony in Tokyo, in the Tokyo Olympics. Do you remember?
There was a deal.
Yeah, they are. And they are very, from what I've been reading, they're very laid back. They're very laid back guys. They're on TV. They're not like very starry. They're very chilled.
They don't sound laid back in that track.
and sorry, listeners, I need to find out why is it called Bling Bang Bang Born? Why they're called Creepy Nuts? Clearly, I haven't done the full research here.
Stay tuned to Monocle Radio yes. for more on the name and the reasons for that. But let's move on to our final track for today. Number one, unsurprisingly, I think it's fair to say, is, of course, the US, the world's largest music market.
Very strong market. And what interests me about the US, Chris, is that, yes, basically the US produced, you know, the pop stars that we all know. But sometimes there are those cases of artists that they stay in the US. And it's quite interesting. And it's the biggest music market, but sometimes it does happen. I'm not sure. I mean, I think this number one might be surprising for some. It's Teddy Swims with Lose Control. Teddy, that's one of his first tracks. It's not quite his first, but he experimented with country, funk, metal. But now I think he's going for more soul pop kind of vibes. It's a very soulful track. Shall we have a listen?
Let's do it.
And you know what's remarkable, Chris? This song took 32 weeks to reach the top of the charts in the US. So it's been a long journey for Teddy Swims. So I find it
which is again a sign of sort of streaming and how that changes things, right? That you can have a sort of slow boil number one like this.
Exactly. In fact, it's the longest run to number one by a solo male artist. So here you go.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Vincent McAvini. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Charmack. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.